Whether you're in line at the grocery store or online at a website, tabloid gossip is easier than ever to indulge in. But snacking on celebrity dish is different from devouring an entire book. For our series, My Guilty Pleasure, we invite authors to recommend a book they're embarrassed to admit they read. Well, today, writer Mark Aceto admits to an obsession with the juicy tell-all memoir.
Starting when I was in the second grade, my father would drop me off at the library on Saturday afternoons while he went to his office. It was the 1970s, when children still roamed free, like wolves. In my case, I headed straight for the adult biography section. You see, biographies for children focus on people who discover life-saving drugs and make the world a better place. But adult biographies focus on the dissolute, the people who do life-threatening drugs and die half-naked on the toilet. This is the world I wanted to know about. The pill-popping, bed-hopping lives of Elvis and Judy Garland and Marilyn Monroe. My latest favorite in the genre is Gladiator, a true story of roids, rage, and redemption. The title alone made me want to read it. Boy meets drugs, boy loses mind, boy finds peace. It's almost mythological. Indeed, I hadn't even heard of the author, Dan Clark, who went by the name Nitro on the TV game show American Gladiators. Clark's story is as compelling as it is pathetic and uplifting. A tale of someone so desperate to make it big, he literally makes himself big. Clark's book does what the best stories do, sweeps us away into another world, one in which he almost gets shot trying to smuggle muscle-building drugs over the border from Mexico. While I wasn't like most second-grade boys, I am like most guys, in that I'd love to have arms the size of ham hocks, to have a body that looks like a bad allergic reaction. But the sad irony of steroids is that two of the side effects are the shrinking of some crucial male anatomy and the development of what Clark calls chesticles, both of which he writes about in graphic, wince-inducing detail. So I chose to experience his misguided life vicariously without adding his mistakes to my own. But why was I so ashamed to read Clark's book that I wouldn't even buy it, then avoided the librarian by using the self-serve? For the same reason, few of us like to admit how much we enjoy the reality TV revolution that American Gladiators helped spawn. A book is an accessory, and there's something inherently unattractive about our appetite for celebrity dish. And I worry there's something unhealthy in our wanting to know how people with more ambition than talent find success, than taking pleasure in their failures. Then again, what would a guilty pleasure be without an overdose of guilt? Guilt.
Mark Aceto admits to taking chocolate protein powder before he lifts weights in Portland, Oregon. We turn our attention now to bloodsuckers.
I am Dracula.
I'm afraid I'm not as warm as the men that you must be accustomed to.
Do you still want death? Or have you tasted it enough?
Without me, Transylvania will be as exciting as Bucharest.
For decades, Americans have been fascinated with vampires on TV, the big screen, and in books. They're enjoying a particular resurgence these days, thanks to the HBO series True Blood and the wildly popular Twilight books and movies. But look closely.
Look closely, and you'll notice that our vampires now are very different from, say, the vampires of the 1980s or even the 1990s. That's because they reflect who we are as a culture and have changed with us over the years. So what is it about the spirit of the times that's making bloodsuckers so popular these days? NPR's Margot Adler has read 75 vampire novels in the last 7 months, and she was ready to take this one on.
I'll get to why I ended up reading 75 vampire novels later, but let's back up. First of all, while vampires have been a constant of folklore, our modern notion of the vampire came out of a particular cultural moment in a chalet in Switzerland in 1816. There, Mary Shelley, Lord Byron, and John Polidori were doing a kind of literary exercise. Whitley Strieber, the author of three vampire novels, including The Hunger, says out of that moment came two things.
Frankenstein, the novel, and John Polidori's Vampire, which is the first vampire story in the English language. There's a reason that this happened. A shocking thing was occurring. Science was beginning to seem to be able to challenge the very nature of life itself.
Since then, vampires have been used again and again as a way to speak of things people fear.
It's almost this perfect empty vessel.
Eric Newsom is the author of The Dead Travel Fast, Stalking Vampires from Nosferatu to Count Chocula. He's also NPR's Director of Programming and Acquisitions.
If you want to understand any moment in time or cultural moment, just look at their vampires. And that really tells you a lot about them.
So, for example, take Bram Stoker's Dracula. It was written at the end of the 19th century at a time when England had some of the largest ports in the world. And here you have a ship that's arriving from Eastern Europe, bearing soil from another country, and a plague-like person who's going to bring death and destruction. Benita Blessing teaches modern European history at Ohio University. At that time, she says, people were concerned with foreign illnesses.
With issues like unwanted immigrants. So anything that might come in to one of the world's largest ports is all of a sudden a big fear. This is exactly what Dracula is all about. It's all about the fear of what we might today call globalization.
The famous Bela Lugosi film Dracula came out during the Great Depression in a time of great chaos.
There are far worse things waiting man than death.
Just as the surge of interest in vampires during the 1980s is usually attributed to the Cold War and spread of AIDS. That was the time of Anne Rice's Interview with a Vampire and Strieber's The Hunger. Strieber says it was a period when people were waiting for something to go wrong as the Soviet Empire was collapsing.
Would they push the button in a desperate attempt to survive? And this kind of entered the unconscious.
In fact, there were about four times as many vampire movies made in 1980 as 1990. It's almost as if when the Berlin Wall came down, there was just a lot less fear to write and think about. But what about now? Kimberly Pauly has written an incredibly funny vampire book for teens that turns the genre on its head. It's called It Sucks to Be Me. She believes vampires are attractive right now because we're in a time somewhat similar to the Depression.
We're in a time of chaos. You know, vampires are immortal. They're not hurt by the, you know, goings-on of everyday life. They kind of stand above it. And I think that's probably the most appealing factor about a vampire is that no matter what's going on in the world around you, you're going to make it through.
And full disclosure, that's probably why I ended up reading 75 vampire novels. I have a seriously ill loved one, and I've been spending a lot of time thinking deeply about issues of mortality and even fantasizing what it would be like not to have to think about that. But what I started noticing as I read all these novels and looked at all the recent shows is that the near immortality of vampires is not the most interesting thing going on. Almost all of them are struggling to be moral. And while it's conventional to talk about vampires as sexual, drinking blood and so forth, most of these modern vampires are not talking as much about sex as they are about power. Take this scene from the CBS show Moonlight, which aired for only one season, ending in 2008. Mick St. John is a very moral vampire private eye. You know the basic American notion that we have laws to keep our baser instincts in check? Well, here Mick St. John is unsuccessfully trying to reason with a new violent rogue vampire by telling him...
We have rules.
There are no rules. I'm top of the food chain.
These are people. They're human beings. You used to be a human.
You know, we're at the top of the food chain. We get to do what we want versus, you know, we were human. How can you just treat humans as if they're cattle?
Amy Smith is a professor of English at the University of the Pacific. Along with courses on Jane Austen and the literature of war, she teaches a course on vampires.
For me, this, the central question of so many vampire films and novels is, if you had power over other people, how would you use it? Which I think is why people keep going back to them. Because that's the tension we have in life. If you earn more money than other people, suddenly you find that you have power. How will you use it?
Power is a personal as well as global issue, says Smith. How do you treat someone you love?
We're always asking ourselves, how should we behave? The core question stays the same. Does might make right?
In True Blood, the HBO series based on the Sookie Stackhouse novels by Charlene Harris, vampires have become legal citizens drinking a form of synthetic blood. But that doesn't solve everything.
You don't like vampires, even though you are one.
I am a vampire. I am supposed to be tormented.
In this scene, Bill Compton, who was turned into a vampire after the Civil War, envies a young vampire teenager who does not have to confront an evil and violent past.
It's so different for her. When I was made, one had no choice but to live completely outside the human world. As an outlaw. a hunter.
Whether it's Bill Compton wanting to embrace his humanity in True Blood or the entire Cullen family in the Twilight Saga, they're all struggling to be moral, even though they are by nature predators. And who are we? Author Whitley Strieber says we humans are just a different kind of predator.
Our prey is our planet.
Today, he says the main fear isn't the Cold War or AIDS, it's ecological catastrophe.
We sense that there's something wrong with the environment, that the planet itself may not be able to sustain us very long, and we are beginning to romance death once again.
The New York Times columnist Ross Douthat wrote recently, "We are beasts with self-consciousness, predators with ethics, mortal creatures who yearn for immortality." Exactly. Maybe that's why vampires aren't really a fad, because except for that near immortality bit, they really are us. Margo Adler, NPR News.
You can find an annotated list of the 75 vampire books that Margo read at our website, npr.org.
Imagine you're sitting in a meeting at work or at home eating dinner with your family when suddenly you feel the need to walk. Not to stretch your legs, not to get some fresh air, but to walk compulsively, uncontrollably, without stop, for miles and miles until you collapse in exhaustion. This is the condition that afflicts the main character in the new novel from Joshua Ferris titled The Unnamed. And Joshua Ferris joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about this walking man. His name is Tim Farnsworth. He's a partner in a high-powered law firm in Manhattan. He's got a wife and a daughter, and he also has this mysterious affliction that hijacks his body. What happens?
Well, I would say, first of all, that it's not really a feeling he has to walk, but really his body overtaking him and forcing him to walk. So it's more of a disease rather than a compulsion. He himself doesn't quite know if this is the case, and it's part of an element of the book that sort of discusses whether or not it's a mental condition or a physical, organic disease. But eventually it concludes more or less that this is something that he's simply not in control of.
One episode comes late at night. He's taking out the garbage from his home in the suburbs. He's wearing a bathrobe. And it hits him again. He's had a remission. Why don't you read this section for us, Joshua? This is on page 33.
He walked past neighbors' houses. He walked barefoot down Route 22. He walked past the supermarket, empty parking lot, and an eerie glow. He walked past the Korean Baptist Church and the Saks-anchored mall into the dreams of late-night drivers who took home the image of some addled derelict in a cotton robe menacing the soft shoulder. He looked down at his legs. It was like watching footage of legs walking from the point of view of the walker. That was the helplessness. This was the terror. The brakes are gone. The steering wheel has locked. I am at the mercy of this wayward machine.
And often what happens is these episodes come in freezing cold weather. His wife, Jane, does this to try to help him. She packs up a survival backpack. She puts all kinds of stuff in it, a GPS device, energy bars, a first aid kit, because when he starts walking, he can't turn back. She wants him to have this pack on him all the time.
He has no control over where his body is taking him, and he has no control over where eventually his body will release him. And when it releases him, he has no energy to do anything but collapse in exhaustion. So it falls to his wife to take care of him and pick him up wherever he might be.
And he and his wife both seek all sorts of medical insight. They go to the Mayo Clinic and see all kinds of doctors. He gets MRIs. He takes bat wing extract at some point. But nothing can be determined. This is an unnamed illness, and that there, of course, is the title of your book.
It's unnamed. It's undiagnosable. It's essentially incurable. As you mentioned earlier, it's recurring and remitting, so he has long stretches of time in which he's not afflicted. And over the course of the book, you see one of these sections and understand the way in which Tim, and I think sick people in general, re-embrace life and recognize that which has been taken away from them when their sickness hits.
How did this come to you, this notion of a man who could not stop walking?
I can't reconstruct the exact idea, but I knew that I wanted to talk about sickness without any of those pre-existing back doors that some sicknesses have. Some of the pre-existing cures and sources of alleviation. When we think of cancer, you know, radiation and chemotherapy come to mind. I wanted to strip down this character to the very barest essentials and see what happens when sickness can't go away and it can't be answered by all of the medical technology that the country has at its disposal.
So the reader, too, would be bringing no preconceptions of what this disease would be.
Ideally, you would look at this as the essence of sickness distilled to its purest form and discover what that really means, what it really means not only to be an individual who is suffering from this completely debilitating disease, but also a family who has to struggle through the uncertainties of it and all of its demands.
This is it's a grim trajectory for this character. I mean, he gets badly frostbitten. His body falls terribly apart. He loses his job, walks away from his family. And there is some redemption, but it's a downward spiral. And I wonder if you knew that going in, that that's sort of where this path would lead.
I wanted to track the length of a man's life. And I also knew that this was going to be, at a certain point in time, an unremitting disease. So he would be stuck with it for life. I expected as I was riding along that it really wasn't going to have any easy answers. And I'm thinking, this is probably not going to end happily. But hopefully there are some things in the book that alleviate that relentlessness for the reader. I think some grace notes that are given to each of the characters that, while maybe not happy in a conventional sense, do bestow some sense of grace upon them.
What was it like at the end for you as a writer to leave this character, Tim Farnsworth, behind?
Well, the grace note that I mentioned helped me enormously because it was difficult to sort of watch him toward the end of the book. And to leave him, I think, on the note with which I leave him was essential. It wasn't essential only for the book and for Tim, but for me as the writer. But it was difficult. I mean, whenever you work on a novel for a number of years, it's difficult to relinquish. But here in particular, given the circumstances, I think that I felt a particular closeness to him because of his suffering. And I knew that I was done, but I wanted to keep going back and making sure that it was perfect. So it was tough to leave him.
Did the ending change over time?
The ending, actually, the very ending came to me early on, maybe halfway through writing of the book. And I had always known that that's how I wanted to end it, but I didn't know when I would write it. And I ended up being in a Home Depot with my dad, and I wrote it on my BlackBerry because I knew exactly what I wanted to say right at that moment. And when I'm always completely useless in a Home Depot. So I took the BlackBerry out and started to write it and finished it in the Home Depot as well.
Which aisle were you in?
I have no memory of really being in there. I can only tell you what my BlackBerry looks like.
So something about the spigots and the 2x4s was inspiring.
The fact that I know nothing about the Home Depot or what's in it was inspiring me to think about other things. And so I just got on, well, here's how I'll end the book.
Well, Joshua Ferris, it's good to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. Nice to talk to you.
In 1975, a 3,000-year-old monarchy reportedly ended with a pillow to the face. Haile Selassie, the last emperor of Ethiopia, was said to be a descendant of King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. After 40 years on the throne, he's widely believed to have been murdered in his bed by revolutionaries, too impatient to wait for an old man to die in peace. Those last days of the monarchy and the brutal beginnings of the socialist military junta that replaced it provide the backdrop of Maza Mengistu's first novel. Beneath the Lion's Gaze tells the story of a family and a nation at war with itself. Maza Mengistu joins us from our New York bureau. Welcome.
Hello, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So may I ask you, how much time have you spent in Ethiopia? Were you born there?
I was born in Ethiopia in Addis Ababa during the early days of the revolution, and I left when I was quite young, but I still had family in Ethiopia, so I went back on a regular basis. And as I was writing this book, I went back also and did some research.
And in your novel, which actually tells the story of a family's evolution during this time, you also provide some detail into the Empress' final moments. The Empress' death is widely believed to have been murder, although the military revolutionaries, the Derg, claimed that he had died of natural causes. In your story, you describe his death with some detail. How did you come to that image of Haile Selassie at the end of his life?
When Emperor Haile Selassie died in August of 1975, the day after he died, the Derg had put an announcement out on the radio saying that he had died from natural causes, from surgery. And everyone knew that wasn't the case. And it wasn't until the Derg fell, the regime fell in 91, 92, that stories started coming out. And it became widely believed that he was actually either smothered or strangled. And so I worked with that when I was imagining the last days of his life in my book. I was trying to imagine not just this emperor that could trace his lineage back 3,000 years to King Solomon, but I was trying to think of what it might feel like to be an 82, 83-year-old man and suddenly isolated from everyone that you know, and you're quite possibly facing the last days of your life.
You also depict his rule in a wider context in terms of its effect on Ethiopians. As the characters in your novel discover for themselves, you know, this was an emperor who rewarded some of his people but neglected most of them.
Yes, you know, and as I was researching, I was trying to answer my own questions about how could the famine get this bad without a lot of help from the government. And one of my characters who is working in the famine-stricken areas, and one of my other characters, Mickey, is talking to him, says, the emperor did come, but it was too late. Help did come, but, you know, it didn't happen fast enough.
So we should say that in the end, the exposure of a famine in Ethiopia seemed to be the catalyzing factor that propelled action against the throne.
Yes, the famine really was the thing that just broke the floodgates of unrest. There was already protests going on. There were demonstrations. You know, the army was upset with low pay and poor living conditions. People wanted reform, and there were deep, deep class divisions and ethnic conflict. And then everybody started hearing about this famine and the how bad it was. And that was it at that point.
Let's talk about this military coup that brought the monarchy down. Now, this is a group that called itself the Derg. The Derg was led by a man by the name of
Mengistu Haile Mariam.
Right, who does not figure in your novel by name.
No.
I wondered about that. Why is that so?
You know, I had to make a decision in this book as to when I would stick to historical fact or historical names and when I would begin to use fictional accounts and fictional names. With the emperor, because he was such a legend and such a myth in many ways, I was able to work with him as a fiction writer. I was able to imagine certain things that people may not know. With Mengistu, he was very, very real, very immediate. And for me to try to step into his shoes and imagine him, I think I would have to make some sacrifices in terms of the story I told. I wanted this book to be about the victims of the Derg, not exactly the perpetrators of this violence. I wanted to focus on those who suffered.
But, you know, there are some estimates that say that, you know, hundreds of thousands of people perished under the Derg, you know, under the, was it 15 years or so that the Derg was in power about that?
Yes.
And so by not naming Mengistu, do you feel as if perhaps you're protecting the guilty? I mean, this guy's alive. He's in Zimbabwe as we speak.
Yes.
Unless he's taken a
on vacation somewhere.
Why spare him? Why protect the guilty?
It wasn't for me about sparing him. I think it was about exposing the humanity and the devastation of those people that suffered under his rule. If I put Mengistu in this book, he would have overshadowed the stories of everybody else. You know, it's funny because I thought about, am I protecting him? And I don't think I am, because anybody who reads this book will probably wonder, I wonder who this man is. And in the back of my book, I do name him. I'm hoping that if we can understand the humanity of those who suffered through this, that we start to investigate beyond the pages of this book and start to wonder, why isn't he in Ethiopia? Why hasn't his life sentence and then death penalty, why haven't those things happened?
Maza Mengistu wrote Beneath the Lion's Gaze. She joined us from our New York bureau. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.